This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. United Nations Chief Antonio Guterres urged Russia and Ukraine on Tuesday to agree to demilitarize perimeter around the Russia-held Zaporizhia nuclear power plant in Ukraine. Speaking before the UN Security Council, Guterres' comments were echoed by the International Atomic Energy Agency's Director General Rafael Mariano Rossi. The UN nuclear watchdog on Tuesday issued a report on the situation in Ukraine, including at the Russia-held nuclear power plant, with recommendations on stopping the shelling and establishing safety systems, staff conditions, off-site power, supply chains, emergency preparedness, and communication. The U.S. military will test launch an intercontinental missile, ballistic missile, on Wednesday, adding it has notified Russia in advance. The Pentagon described the test as routine and said it was meant to demonstrate the readiness of the U.S.'s military ICBM forces. The United States last month carried out a test of the Minuteman III ICBM, which has been delayed to avoid escalating tensions with Beijing during a Chinese show of force near Taiwan. Fears are running high on an indigenous reserve in the Canadian province of Saskatchewan after police warned that the suspect in a deadly stabbing rampage over the weekend might be nearby, and officers surrounded a house with guns drawn. Police later sent out an alert that it was a false alarm and they had determined the suspect was not in the community, but people remain nervous with his whereabouts unknown and a province-wide alert still in effect. People in the James Smith Cree First Nation Reserve were earlier told to stay inside. This is VOA News. Liz Truss became UK Prime Minister Tuesday and immediately faced up to the enormous task ahead of her. That's curbing soaring prices, boosting the economy, easing labor unrest, and fixing a national health care system burdened by long waiting lists and staff shortages. Truss quickly began appointing senior members of her cabinet as she tackles an inbox dominated by the energy crisis triggered by the Russia invasion of Ukraine, which threatens to push energy bills to unaffordable levels, shuttering businesses and leaving the nation's poorest people shivering at home this winter. Truss, Britain's third female prime minister, named a top team diverse in gender and ethnicity, but loyal to her and her free market politics. Kwasi Kwarteng becomes the first black UK Treasury chief, and Therese Coffey, its first female deputy prime minister. Other appointments include James Cleverly as foreign secretary and Suella Braverman as home secretary responsible for immigration and law and order. A record-breaking heat wave is making life miserable in the U.S. state of California, the AP's Ed Donahue reports.
The state capital, Sacramento, reached a record high for the day, 115 degrees. Contractor Sean Clifton was staying hydrated.
We have our little tricks to keep cool. Everybody does. And we just keep going.
This heat could feel even more miserable if there are blackouts. Turning up the air conditioning strains the power supply.
Everyone has to do their part to help step up for just a few more days.
Governor Gavin Newsom says run the air conditioner early when there is more power available. Later,
in particular, 4 p.m., please turn your thermostat up to 78 degrees or higher and avoid, to the extent possible, using any really large appliances.
It's not just miserable in California. In Utah, in Salt Lake City, the temperature reached 105 degrees, the hottest September day recorded going back to 1874. I'm Ed Donahue.
Authorities say that a shark has attacked and killed a U.S. cruise ship passenger who was snorkeling in waters around the Bahamas. Tuesday's attack involved a 58-year-old woman from Pennsylvania and occurred at a popular snorkeling spot near Green Cay in the northern Bahamas. According to police spokeswoman Chief Superintendent Chrislyn Skippings to the Associated Press, Skippings said the woman's family identified it as a bull shark. The majority of shark attacks in the Caribbean have occurred in the Bahamas, with two reported in 2019, one of them fatal. Recapping our top story, the United Nations Chief Antonio Guterres urged Russia and Ukraine on Tuesday to agree to a demilitarized perimeter around the Russian-held nuclear power plant in Ukraine. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Thank you. Today's Wednesday, September 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Gina Rofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, U.S. tests intercontinental ballistic missile as Russia holds war drills with China.
This launch is a routine test, which was scheduled far in advance, and consistent with previous tests, this ICBM launch will validate and verify effectiveness and readiness of the system.
Ukraine continues counteroffensive in the south of the country as the UN calls for security zone around an atomic power plant.
And according to all the reports that we have, both from the Ukrainian military authorities and from the international experts and the Institute for the Study of War as well, we see that these actions are quite active.
And dozens of children die in Somalia as farming looms. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. The Pentagon said the U.S. military will test launch an intercontinental ballistic missile on Wednesday, adding it has notified Russia in advance. The Pentagon described the test as routine and said it was meant to demonstrate the readiness of the U.S. military's ICBM forces. The United States last month carried out a test of a minute Mann 3 ICBM, which had been delayed to avoid escalating tensions with Beijing during a Chinese shore force near Taiwan. Pentagon Press Secretary Brigadier General Pat Ryder.
There will be an operational test launch of an Air Force Global Strike Command unarmed Minuteman III intercontinental ballistic missile early tomorrow morning, September 7, from Vandenberg Space Force Base in California. This launch is a routine test, which was scheduled far in advance, and consistent with previous tests, this ICBM launch will validate and verify effectiveness and readiness of the system. In accordance with standard procedures, the United States has transmitted a pre-launch notification pursuant to the Hague Code of Conduct and notified the Russian government in advance pursuant to treaty obligations. The purpose of the ICBM test launch program is to demonstrate the readiness of U.S. nuclear forces and provide confidence in the security and effectiveness of the nation's nuclear deterrent. As you may recall, the last test launch was August 4th. Which had been delayed. So for those wondering about timing, the two launches moved closer together due to the delays from the August date sliding to the right. And again, tomorrow's launch was scheduled far in advance.
That's Pentagon Press Secretary Brigadier General Pat Ryder. The International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, called on Tuesday for fighting to be halted in a security zone around Europe's biggest nuclear power station, saying its experts had found extensive damage at the plant on the front in the Ukrainian war. This as Ukrainian forces continue their push in the nation's south, with government officials saying troops have liberated another village that was previously occupied by Russian troops. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv briefs Flashpoint Ukraine's Steve Miller.
Officials are trying to highlight that this is counteroffensive actions which are going on. And according to all the reports that we have, both from the Ukrainian military authorities and from the international experts and the Institute for the Study of War as well, we see that these actions are quite active. And Ukrainian general staff is trying not to comment too much on this situation to keep it more or less secret. But still, we receive confirmations on certain liberations. And yesterday, it was confirmed that the village of Vysokopilia was liberated, and today we have also confirmation that the village of Olhino, which is neighboring village to the previous one, was also liberated. The representative of the president office, Mr. Arestovich, also mentioned that there are other places that probably general staff will also report on, but for the moment they're not announced, but apparently there are more villages which were actually back to the Ukrainian control, but again, this we cannot confirm for the moment. So we know that Ukrainian forces continued very targeted attacks and they continue to fire control the logistics routes that enables Russian forces to actually proceed with their actions. So for the moment, we're just waiting and continue to keep an eye on what's going on there.
But I also wanted to turn our attention to the Donbass and Kharkiv, which has been an area of intense fighting really since the beginning of the conflict back in February. And I believe that there's some updates on some of the Ukrainian military operations in that region.
Yes, actually, very active also shelling and fightings are happening around Kharkiv region and around the city of Kharkiv itself, because it is very close to the border with Russia, and Russian forces are actively shelling the city. Yesterday in the evening, President Zelensky confirmed this and announced that Ukrainian forces managed to destroy Russian warhouse with S-300 missiles. These are very missiles which are used by Russian forces for Kharkiv attacks. And this is quite a huge announcement, because for the past couple of weeks, we see very intensifying shelling of the city of Kharkiv, and in particularly the central parts of the city, and pretty much the main target is residential areas. And despite this announcement by President Zelensky, today in the morning, it was another shelling of the city of Kharkiv, and again, the central part, and again, residential area. And for the moment, we know that very bad damages were at one of the buildings, where three entrances to the residential buildings were actually destroyed. It was a direct hit by a Russian missile. And according to the officials, three people, two women and one man, have been already rescued from under the rubble of the building. But rescue operation is going on. And unfortunately, this hit happened at around 9 o'clock in the morning. And a lot of people were actually there inside the building. So we're waiting till we have final information, because information about the victims is being clarified.
That's reporter Anna Chernikova speaking with Flashpoint Ukraine Steve Miller from Kyiv. Russia's invasion of Ukraine has driven Moscow and Beijing closer, according to a new report that warns of the possibility of Russia and China supporting each other in any future conflict. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
Russia is this month hosting the Vostok 22 military exercises in the east of the country. 15 countries are taking part, and China is Russia's guest of honour. The drills have been broadcast on state television in both countries. Rear Admiral Valery Kazakov of Russia's Pacific Fleet was pictured on Russian state television, saying the practical interaction between the Russian Navy and the Navy of the Chinese People's Liberation Army has reached a new level in terms of quality. This ensures global and regional stability and security. China and Russia do not yet have a formal military alliance, but share deepening military ties, according to a report from the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. Arms sales are also a vital part of the relationship, but there are difficulties, says Bonnie Lin, one of the authors of the report.
China imports about 70% of its total arms from Russia. But by the mid-2000s, China began focusing more on domestic production of its arms, so less reliant on Russia. At the same time, Russia became more concerned about Chinese theft of its technology. And more recently, in the past couple of years, most of China's imports from Russia on the arms sales side have been to support its aircraft programs.
China has tacitly supported Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Again, Bonnie Lin.
Beijing is doing quite a bit of mirror imaging between what it views as Russia's, the problems that Russia faced dealing with the West and NATO, and the problems that Beijing faces right now dealing with the United States and our closest allies and partners in the Indo-Pacific.
The report cautions that the Ukraine conflict has driven Russia and China closer.
I'm not saying that, for example, Russia would put boots on the ground in a China conflict with one of its neighbors, but it could provide other forms of support, including intelligence, including even political support.
The report says China's military capabilities are catching up with or surpassing those of Russia. The Kremlin's invasion of Ukraine has stalled. The report authors say a Russian failure there could lead Beijing to reevaluate its military relationship with Moscow. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
White House spokesperson Karine Jean-Pierre said on Tuesday that U.S. President Joe Biden has made a final decision about designating Russia as a state sponsor of terror. Biden on Monday said Russia should not be designated a state sponsor of terrorism, a label Ukraine has pushed for amid Russia's ongoing invasion, while Moscow has warned it will rupture U.S.-Russian ties. Jean-Pierre said the designation of Russia as a state sponsor of terror could delay food exports and jeopardize deals to move foods through the Black Sea.
It is not the most effective or strongest path forward, as we have said many times before, to hold Russia accountable. This designation could have unintended consequences to Ukraine and the world. For example, according to humanitarian experts and NGOs we have spoken to, it could seriously affect the ability to deliver assistance in areas of Ukraine. Another one is it could drive critical humanitarian and commercial actors away from facilitating food exports to help mitigate the global food crisis and jeopardize the Black Sea port deal that has already led to over 1 million tons of Ukrainian food exports reaching the world, including those on the Horn of Africa likely facing famine. It would also undercut our unprecedented multilateral condition that has been so effective to holding Putin accountable and could also undermine our ability to support Ukraine at the negotiation tables.
That's White House spokesperson Karine Jean-Pierre. The UN's Children's Fund said hundreds of children in Somalia have already died in food and nutrition centers the day after warnings that parts of the country will be hit by famine this autumn. Maya Womersley of Reuters has more.
That grim revelation comes the day after the UN's humanitarian chief warned that parts of the country will be hit by famine in the coming months. Experts say the Horn of Africa is heading towards a fifth consecutive failed rainy season, further exacerbating the region's worst drought in decades. UNICEF's Somalia representative, Wafa Saeed, told a press conference in Geneva that 730 children have been reported to have died in food and nutrition centres between January and July this year.
And to put it into perspective, this is less than 1% of the children who were admitted and cured and discharged. But we also fear that this number could be more as many deaths of children go unreported.
UNICEF said disease outbreaks were increasing among children. There have been some 13,000 suspected measles cases reported in recent months, of which 78% were children under five.
Malnutrition has reached unprecedented level. We have 1.5 million children. This is nearly half of the children under five are likely to have acute malnutrition. And of them, 385,000 will need treatment for severe acute malnutrition.
On Monday, UN Humanitarian Chief Martin Griffiths said famine is at the door in Somalia. He said there were concrete indications that parts of South Central Somalia would be hit between October and December this year. Funding for Somalia has increased in recent weeks, with the UN's $1.46 billion appeal now 67% funded. But aid officials warned that it had come very late and that more was needed.
That's Mia Womersley of Reuters. In other news, a powerful typhoon has hit South Korea, dumping 3 feet of rain, destroying roads and knocking down power lines. But officials say the death toll of six could have been higher if not for proactive evacuations and school closures. Government officials had put the nation on high alert 4 days as Typhoon Hinam Noor approached, warning of potentially historic destruction. After grazing the resort island of Jeju and hitting the mainland near the port city of Busan, Hinam Noor weakened over the sea. It still caused damage in the southern city of Pohang, where 5 people were found dead and at least 5 others remain missing. The storm submerged roads and buildings, triggered landslides, and flooded a shopping mall. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com and check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition and our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference on U.S. and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We're on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. The United Nations is rapidly scaling up its relief operation in Pakistan amid fears the situation could deteriorate as more rains are predicted in the coming month. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Torrential monsoon rains and floods in Pakistan have killed more than 1,200 people and affected upwards of 33 million, rendering millions homeless and causing widespread destruction and damage to homes and infrastructure. Forecasts of more rain in the coming weeks are spurring aid agencies to action. The UN Refugee Agency reports the first 3 of 9 scheduled flights carrying sleeping mats, kitchen sets, tarpaulins, and other supplies arrived Monday in Pakistan. 6 more flights are scheduled to leave Dubai Wednesday and Thursday. The UNHCR's Director for Asia and the Pacific, Indrikya Ratwat, says tents and other core relief items will be trucked into Pakistan from Uzbekistan. He says an initial 50,000 households in the worst flood-hit region are prioritized for aid. He says it is urgent to reach communities in situ, that is, close to their homes.
They don't want to go away from the areas because that's where they have whatever's left. The food insecurity is going to be huge because the crops are devastated, obviously, and the little they had in terms of homesteads, livestock is also destroyed. So really, getting the assistance in situ right now, ramping it up, is what is needed.
Ratwat says the UNHCR is dispatching all existing humanitarian stocks in the country to help some 420,000 of the hardest-hit Afghan refugees and the Pakistan communities hosting them. An estimated 1.3 million Afghan refugees currently are registered in the country. The World Health Organization, for its part, has delivered $1.5 million in essential medicines, water purification kits, tanks, tents, and other emergency supplies. WHO spokesman Tarek Jazarevich says there is an urgent need to scale up disease surveillance, restore damaged health facilities, and provide mental health and psychosocial support to affected communities.
As the situation is still expected to worsen because of floods that are persistent in many parts, and especially for the most vulnerable, we are trying to respond to the current health impact of the floods while at the same time scaling up preparedness for additional health risks as we expect more monsoon rains in coming months.
The WHO says the floods have damaged more than 1,000 health facilities and destroyed more than 430. That, it says, limits access to health facilities, essential medicine, and medical equipment, as well as treatment for diseases, injuries, and trauma. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Australia plans to hold a referendum to legally enshrine Indigenous voices in politics. Campaigners argue it will help address deep-seated inequality, but not everyone is convinced. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Australia's recently elected Labor government wants to change the constitution to recognise First Nations people. It also plans to mandate consultation with them on decisions that affect their lives by adding a so-called Indigenous voice to Parliament. The Australian Constitution can only be altered by referendum or a national popular vote. Labor has enlisted high-profile international support for its proposed reforms to help Indigenous people. Former US basketball star Shaquille O'Neal, known for his social justice campaigning in the United States, was in Canberra last weekend and has agreed to appear in videos promoting Labor's plan. No date for the referendum has been set. Eddie Sinnott, an Aboriginal community leader, says it's time the country's original inhabitants were officially recognised.
What we're dealing with now is the kind of first principles idea that, you know, there's the symbolic part of recognition and the rightful place of First Nations, but also this fundamental, simple idea that Indigenous peoples, you know, have particular issues, have rights as Indigenous peoples. You know, our voice should be heard on the decisions that affect us.
The plan, however, doesn't have universal support. Some Indigenous leaders, including Green Senator Lydia Thorpe, a federal lawmaker, has said it was a waste of money, saying the funds used to hold the referendum could be better spent in Aboriginal communities. Critics have argued an Indigenous voice to Parliament isn't the answer to the crises facing First Nations communities. David Littleproud, the leader of the opposition Nationals Party, also has concerns about the plan's lack of detail.
We haven't got any detail to vote on, and I think all Australians are starting from scratch. And this policy area is littered with good intentions, but little in terms of shifting the dial of closing the gap.
There remains a large gap in the health and well-being of Indigenous people and other Australians. Their life expectancy is shorter by up to 10 years, and they suffer disproportionately high rates of poverty, unemployment and imprisonment. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This is Science in a Minute. Researchers at New York Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai have released a new study that proposes astronauts have a higher risk of developing mutations in their DNA that can increase their risk of developing cancer and heart disease sometime during their lifetimes. The study also suggests that the mutations may possibly be associated with spaceflight. The researchers collected blood samples from 14 NASA astronauts who flew in space shuttle missions between 1998 and 2001. Upon examining the blood samples, the researchers say they found DNA mutations, called somatic mutations, in the blood-forming systems of the astronauts. The researchers define somatic mutations as those that take place in cells other than sperm or egg cells after an individual is conceived, meaning that the mutations cannot be passed on to their children. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and our panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including a federal judge granted former President Donald Trump's request to appoint a special master to review materials that were seized by the FBI during its search of his Mar-a-Lago residence on August 8th. We'll examine this and more on Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And check out voaafrica.com for English language programming. You can find International Edition and our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA, and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The State Department has barred Paraguay and Vice President Hugo Velasquez from entering the United States due to his involvement in significant corruption, including bribery of a public official and interference in public processes, said Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Vice President Velasquez announced his resignation from office and will no longer run for president in the next election. The United States also designated Yacyretá Binational Entity Legal Counsel Juan Carlos Charlie Duarte for involvement in significant corruption. Duarte, a close personal and professional associate of Vice President Velasquez, offered a bribe to a Paraguayan public official in order to obstruct an investigation that threatened the vice president and his financial interests, explained Secretary Blinken in a statement. Corrupt acts such as these also contribute to diminished confidence in the government and public perceptions of corruption and impunity within the office of the Paraguayan vice president, he added. Moreover, Duarte's act of corruption abused and exploited his privileged public position within the Yacyretá binational entity, risking public confidence in one of Paraguay's most vital economic assets. Duarte has since been removed from his post at Yacyretá, said Paraguayan President Mario Abdo Benitez. The U.S. Department of State also designated Velasquez's immediate family members as ineligible to enter the United States, including Lourdes Maria Andrea Samaniego Gonzalez, Dionisio Adalberto Velasquez Jimenez, Sonia Rebecca Velasquez Esquariza, and Hugo Jose Velasquez Esquariza, and Duarte's immediate family members, including Ninfa Concepcion Vera Morera and Tamara Duarte Martinez. These designations reaffirm the commitment of the United States to combat corruption, which harms the public interest, hampers countries' economic prosperity, and curtails the ability of governments to respond effectively to the needs of their people. The United States continues to stand with all Paraguayans in support of democracy and the rule of law, and will continue to promote accountability for those who abuse public power for personal gain, regardless of their position or political affiliation.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.